Chapter 11. Its presence meant, I have had a little whim, apostrophe he explained when they were in the dark. Have you? Apostrophe apostrophe says she. To erect a little shrine, as it may be called. Apostrophe apostrophe, a little shrine? Apostrophe apostrophe, yes. To one whom we both equally adore, eh? I'll show you what it contains. Apostrophe apostrophe, he pulled a cord which hung covered by the bed curtains, and the doors of the wardrobe slowly opened, disclosing that the shelves within had been removed throughout, and the interior adapted to receive the ghastly figure, which stood there as it had stood in the boudoir, but with a wax candle burning on each side of it to throw the cropped and distorted features into relief. She clutched him, uttered a low scream, and buried her head in the bedclothes. Oh, take it away, please take it away. Apostrophe apostrophe, she implored. All in good time, namely, when you love me best, apostrophe he returned calmly. You don't quite yet, eh? Apostrophe, I don't know, I think, oh Upland Towers, have mercy, I cannot bear it, oh, in pity, take it away. Apostrophe apostrophe, nonsense. One gets accustomed to anything. Take another gaze. Apostrophe, in short, he allowed the doors to remain unclosed at the foot of the bed, and the wax tapers burning, and such was the strange fascination of the grisly exhibition, that a morbid curiosity took possession of the Countess as she lay, and, at his repeated request, she did again look out from the coverlet, shuddered, hid her eyes, and looked again, all the while begging him to take it away, or it would drive her out of her senses. But he would not do so as yet, and the wardrobe was not locked till dawn. The scene was repeated the next night. Firm in enforcing his ferocious correctives, he continued the treatment till the nerves of the poor lady were quivering in agony under the virtuous tortures inflicted by her lord, to bring her truant heart back to faithfulness. The third night, when the scene had opened as usual, and she lay staring with immense wild eyes at the horrid fascination, on a sudden she gave an unnatural laugh. She laughed more and more, staring at the image, till she literally shrieked with laughter. Then there was silence, and he found her to have become insensible. He thought as he had fainted, but soon saw that the event was worse. She was in an epileptic fit. He started up, dismayed by the sense that, like many other subtle personages, he had been too exacting for his own interests. Such love as he was capable of, though rather a selfish gloating than a cherishing solicitude, was fanned into life on the instant. He closed the wardrobe with a pulley, clasped her in his arms, took her gently to the window, and did all he could to restore her. It was a long time before the Countess came to herself, and when she did so, a considerable change seemed to have taken place in her emotions. She flung her arms around him, and with gasps of fear abjectly kissed him many times, at last bursting into tears. She had never wept in this scene before. You'll take it away, dearest, you will. Apostrophe apostrophe, she begged plaintively. If you love me. Apostrophe apostrophe, I do, oh, I do. Apostrophe apostrophe, and hate him, and his memory? Apostrophe apostrophe, yes, yes. Apostrophe apostrophe, thoroughly? Apostrophe apostrophe, I cannot endure recollection of him. Apostrophe apostrophe, cried the poor Countess slavishly. It fills me with shame, how could I ever be so depraved? I'll never behave badly again, Upland Towers. And you will never put the hated statue again before my eyes? Apostrophe apostrophe, he felt that he could promise with perfect safety. Never, apostrophe said he. And then I'll love you, apostrophe she returned eagerly, as if dreading lest the skirt should be applied anew. And I'll never, never dream of thinking a single thought that seems like faithlessness to my marriage vow. Apostrophe apostrophe, the strange thing now was that this fictitious love wrung from her by terror took on, through mere habit of enactment, a certain quality of reality. A servile mood of attachment to the Earl became distinctly visible in her contemporaneously with an actual dislike for her late husband's memory. The mood of attachment grew and continued when the statue was removed. A permanent revulsion was operant in her, which intensified as time wore on. How fright could have affected such a change of idiosyncrasy, learned physicians alone can say, but I believe such cases of reactionary instinct are not unknown. The upshot was that the cure became so permanent as to be itself a new disease. She clung to him so tightly that she would not willingly be out of his sight for a moment. She would have no sitting room apart from his, though she could not help starting when he entered suddenly to her. Her eyes were well nigh always fixed upon him. If he drove out, she wished to go with him. His slightest civilities to other women made her frantically jealous, till at length her very fidelity became a burden to him, absorbing his time, and curtailing his liberty, and causing him to curse and swear. If he ever spoke sharply to her now, she did not revenge herself by flying off to a mental world of her own. All that affection for another, which had provided her with a resource, was now a cold black cinder. From that time the life of this scared and enervated lady, whose existence might have been developed to so much higher purpose, but for the ignoble ambition of her parents and the conventions of the time, was one of obsequious amativeness towards a perverse and cruel man. Little personal events came to her in quick succession, half a dozen, eight, nine, ten such events, in brief. She bore him no less than 11 children in the 8 following years, but half of them came prematurely into the world, or died a few days old. Only one, a girl, attained to maturity. She in after years became the wife of the Honorable Mr. Boltonley, who was created Lord Dalmain, as may be remembered. There was no living son and heir. At length, completely worn out in mind and body, Lady Uplandtowers was taken abroad by her husband, to try the effect of a more genial climate upon her wasted frame. But nothing availed to strengthen her, and she died at Florence, a few months after her arrival in Italy. Contrary to expectation, the Earl of Uplandtowers did not marry again. Such affection as existed in him, strange, hard, brutal as it was, seemed untransferable, and the title, as is known, passed at his death to his nephew. Perhaps it may not be so generally known that, during the enlargement of the hall for the 6th Earl, while digging in the grounds for the new foundations, the broken fragments of a marble statue were unearthed. They were submitted to various antiquaries, who said that, so far as the damaged pieces would allow them to form an opinion, the statue seemed to be that of a mutilated Roman satyr, or if not, an allegorical figure of death. Only one or two old inhabitants guessed whose statue those fragments had composed. I should have added that, shortly after the death of the Countess, an excellent sermon was preached by the Dean of Melchester, the subject of which, though names were not mentioned, was unquestionably suggested by the aforesaid events. He dwelt upon the folly of indulgence in sensuous love for a handsome form merely, and showed that the only rational and virtuous growths of that affection were those based upon intrinsic worth. In the case of the tender, but somewhat shallow lady whose life I have related, there is no doubt that an infatuation for the person of young Willows was the chief feeling that induced her to marry him, which was the more deplorable in that his beauty, by all tradition, was the least of his recommendations, every report bearing out the inference that he must have been a man of steadfast nature, bright intelligence, and promising life. The company thanked the old surgeon for his story, which the rural dean declared to be a far more striking one than anything he could hope to tell. An elderly member of the club, who was mostly called the bookworm, said that a woman's natural instinct of fidelity would, indeed, send back her heart to a man after his death in a truly wonderful manner sometimes, if anything occurred to put before her forcibly the original affection between them, and his original aspect in her eyes, whatever his inferiority may have been, social or otherwise. And then a general conversation ensued upon the power that a woman has of seeing the actual in the representation, The reality in the dream may power which, according to the sentimental member, men have no faculty of equaling. The rural dean thought that such cases as that related by the surgeon were rather an illustration of passion electrified back to life than of a latent, true affection. The story had suggested that he should try to recount to them one which he had used to hear in his youth, and which afforded an instance of the latter and better kind of feeling, his heroine being also a lady who had married beneath her, though he feared his narrative would be of a much slighter kind than the surgeon's. The club begged him to proceed, and the parson began. Dame the Third. The Marchioness of Stonehenge by the rural dean. I would have you know, then, that a great many years ago there lived in a classical mansion with which I used to be familiar, standing not 100 miles from the city of Melchester, a lady whose personal charms were so rare and unparalleled that she was courted, flattered, and spoilt by almost all the young noblemen and gentlemen in that part of Wessex. For a time these attentions pleased her well. But as, in the words of good Robert South, whose sermons might be read much more than they are, the most passionate lover of sport, if tied to follow his hawks and hounds every day of his life, would find the pursuit the greatest torment and calamity, and would fly to the mines and galleys for his recreation, so did this lofty and beautiful lady after a while become satiated with the constant iteration of what as he had in its novelty enjoyed, and by an almost natural revulsion turned her regards absolutely netherward, socially speaking. She perversely and passionately centered her affection on quite a plain-looking young man of humble birth, and no position at all, though it is true that he was gentle and delicate in nature, of good address, and guileless heart. In short, he was the parish clerk's son, acting as assistant to the land steward of her father, the Earl of Avon, with the hope of becoming someday a land steward himself. It should be said that perhaps the Lady Caroline, as she was called, was a little stimulated in this passion by the discovery that a young girl of the village already loved the young man fondly, and that he had paid some attentions to her, though merely of a casual and good-natured kind. Since his occupation brought him frequently to the manor house and its environs, Lady Caroline could make ample opportunities of seeing and speaking to him. As he had, in Chaucer's phrase, all the craft of fine loving at her fingers' ends, and the young man, being of a readily kindling heart, was quick to notice the tenderness in her eyes and voice. He could not at first believe in his good fortune, having no understanding of her weariness of more artificial men, but a time comes when the stupidest sees in an eye the glance of his other half, and it came to him, who was quite the reverse of dull. As he gained confidence, accidental encounters led to encounters by design, till at length when they were alone together there was no reserve on the matter. They whispered tender words as other lovers do, and were as devoted a pair as ever was seen. But not a rarer symptom of this attachment was allowed to show itself to the outer world. Now, as she became less and less scrupulous towards him under the influence of her affection, and he became more and more reverential under the influence of his, and they looked the situation in the face together, their condition seemed intolerable in its hopelessness. That she could ever ask to be allowed to marry him, or could hold her tongue and quietly renounce him, was equally beyond conception. They resolved upon a third course, possessing neither of the disadvantages of these two. To wed secretly, and live on an outward appearance the same as before. In this they differed from the lovers of my friend's story. Not a soul in the parental mansion guessed when Lady Caroline came coolly into the hall one day after a visit to her aunt, that, during that visit, her lover and herself had found an opportunity of uniting themselves till death should part them. Yet such was the fact. The young woman who rode fine horses, and drove in pony chaises, and was saluted deferentially by everyone, and the young man who trudged about, and directed the tree felling, and the laying out of fish ponds in the park, were husband and wife. As they had planned, so they acted to the letter for the space of a month and more, clandestinely meeting when and where they best could do so, both being supremely happy and content. To be sure, towards the latter part of that month, when the first wild warmth of her love had gone off, the Lady Caroline sometimes wondered within herself how she, who might have chosen a peer of the realm, baronet, knight, or, if serious-minded, a bishop or judge of the more gallant sort who prefer young wives, could have brought herself to do a thing so rash as to make this marriage, particularly when, in their private meetings, she perceived that, though her young husband, and was full of ideas, and fairly well-read, they had not a single social experience in common. It was his custom to visit her after nightfall, in her own house, when he could find no opportunity for an interview elsewhere, and to further this course she would contrive to leave unfastened a window on the ground floor overlooking the lawn, by entering which a back staircase was accessible, so that he could climb up to her apartments, and gain audience of his lady, when the house was still. One dark midnight, when he had not been able to see her during the day, he made use of this secret method, as he had done many times before, and when they had remained in company about an hour he declared that it was time for him to descend. He would have stayed longer, but that the interview had been a somewhat painful one. What as he had said to him that night had much excited and angered him, for it had revealed a change in her. Cold reason had come to his lofty wife. She was beginning to have more anxiety about her own position and prospects than ardor for him. Whether from the agitation of this perception or not, he was seized with a spasm. He gasped, rose, and in moving towards the window for air he uttered in a short thick whisper, "Oh, my heart!" With his hand upon his chest he sank down to the floor, before he had gone another step. By the time that as he had relighted the candle, which had been extinguished in case any eye in the opposite ground should witness his egress, she found that his poor heart had ceased to beat, and there rushed upon her mind what his cottage friends had once told her, that he was liable to attacks of heart disease, one of which, the doctor had informed them, might someday carry him off. Accustomed as she was to doctoring the other parishioners, nothing that she could effect upon him in that kind made any difference whatever, and his stillness, and the increasing coldness of his feet and hands, disclosed too surely to the affrighted young woman that her husband was dead indeed. For more than an hour, however, she... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.